This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Kansas farmers are running out of water. There's really no other way to put it. On top of that, the Special Committee on Water met in Topeka last week and left without developing a consensus for a clear path forward. Some experts have already concluded that it's too late, and that's putting the state's multi-billion dollar farm industry in peril. One expert quoted in the Topeka Capital Journal said it's time to write the eulogy for much of western Kansas unless farmers and ranchers come together to find a solution. Lucas Basir knows firsthand about the overuse of water in western Kansas. He writes about it in his 2021 book, Running Out, In Search of Water on the High Plains, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Oklahoma, and he joins us now. Lucas, welcome to Up to Date. Nice to have you.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here, and good morning to all your listeners.
Oh, great. And, you know, based on what you wrote in your book, this idea that the Special Committee on Water couldn't reach consensus last week in Topeka doesn't come as a surprise to you. Why is there such a sharp disagreement on a path going forward, given the gravity of this crisis?
You know, that's a great question, and I think the answer is really clear. It's no secret that the aquifer is running out. We know that in many places the water is already gone. It's dropping everywhere in western Kansas. We know that in southwest Kansas, where I'm from, we have some of the highest rates of groundwater loss in the world. We know the stakes couldn't be higher of this loss economically or socially. We know that a lot of folks would like to save some of the water for future generations. And we know it's not so easy to do. And part of the reason is because of the outsized influence of corporate agribusiness in the political process in Kansas. And I think that that was on clear display in the conflicts around the Kansas House Water Committee and the possibilities for intervention. But before we move on, you know, I just think that what can be overlooked in that story is the remarkable process of what almost happened. And that is that there was an incremental process by which the Kansas House Water Committee, under the leadership of Representative Ron Hyland and Representative Lindsey Vonn, went out of their way to build a remarkable restructuring proposal for water governance last year. And they worked across party lines, they worked across the state, and they came up with something that a lot of stakeholders could really support. And it was derailed at the last minute by interventions from powerful corporate lobby.
Well, Lucas, I want to be real clear about something here, and that is there are some farmers, some ranchers in western Kansas who are perfectly okay with tapping into this water and running it dry. They're okay to let the wells run dry and let this play out as long as it can, and then they'll worry about it at that point. Explain that mindset to me.
Yeah, well, the thing to keep in mind when we're talking about this is it's not a what's the matter with Kansas farmers kind of a story. You have Kansas farmers who really have a diversity of perspectives on this issue. Everybody knows it's running out. There's a small group of people who are in favor of doing whatever they can to meet the bottom line and get as much as they can out of it. But there's a lot of guys who are in the middle who would prefer to save the water, but feel compelled to keep pumping because of the way farm finance works, because of the way that their economic operations are set up. And then there's also a small group of farmers who are really going out of their way to try to pioneer new sustainable situations.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of farmers are caught in something of a catch-22. They've borrowed money. Yeah. They've got to grow a heavy crop. The only way to grow a big crop is to use the water and irrigate like crazy. It's sort of a circular firing squad here in a sense, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a self-destructive spiral. And in the absence of effective government, that's what happens.
Hmm. The amount of water that's been brought to the surface over the years is absolutely staggering. And for context here, for thousands of years, water filled the Ogallala beneath the earth. And then in about 80 years' time, you point out, farmers have basically drained the entire thing. I mean, that's simply astonishing to me. How could farmers drain it that quickly?
Yeah, it's really a stunning situation. But to be clear, you know, it's not that the aquifer runs out in a similar uniform way. It's a very uneven formation. And so there's parts that have already run out of water.
Right.
There's parts that are rapidly running out, and there's parts that are pretty stable. So you have a really uneven kind of a scenario out there, which makes it difficult often for people to know how to respond or how to solve it. But the scale of use is really enormous, and it's hard for many people to grasp it. But right now you have something like a quarter of the annual flow of the entire Colorado River Basin being extracted in western Kansas every year. And much of that water is non-renewable, which means it won't come back in many places. And it also creates a situation in which farmers are permitted to pump more than the water that remains. So we're in that kind of a situation, and that's the reality of it. Everybody knows that it's complicated. The good news is that it's not rocket science. The good news is that we have the mechanisms in place. We just have to come together and make that happen.
Again, for the sake of context, what's happening in Kansas is hardly anything unusual. In fact, you point out that groundwater is under threat around the entire globe. Is that for the same reasons?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, groundwater is right now the most extracted natural resource on the planet. And most of the world's dry region aquifers are in steep decline. And that connects in a kind of bizarre way, western Kansas to northern China, to the Indus Basin, to northern Africa, to California's Central Valley, Saudi Arabia and Yemen. I mean, these are places where you have a striking number of similarities in what's happening, where society is dependent on the groundwater resources that are being destroyed. These are productive agricultural regions. They're also home to hardening social divides and new conflicts that come up when the water runs out.
I thought this was interesting, too. In your book, you say that more than half of the water used in agriculture is mined from underground aquifers. I mean, No wonder that groundwater around the globe is under threat here.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that one of the interesting questions that comes up is, what is the real value of groundwater in this kind of a situation where we know that we're facing a future that's going to grow hotter and drier and more populated? And we have a surface water crisis all over. Everybody really knows about that. You know, there's less attention being made to connect that crisis to the aquifer crisis. And I think that, you know, we need to think about the value of our waters, not now, but the value that they're going to have in 20 years, 30 years, and so on.
I'm visiting with Lucas Basir. His 2021 book is titled Running Out in Search of Water on the High Plains. Again, it was a finalist for the National Book Award. So if it wasn't for the Ogallala, then, Lucas, would western Kansas resemble a desert?
Well, you know, desert's all in the eye of the beholder, as they say. You know, early travelers across that area called it the Great American Desert. I mean, it's definitely a place where there's not a lot of rainfall. You know, rainfall varies between 10 and 20 inches a year out there in many places. But it's also, you know, a really rich ecosystem. So the native grasses, the grasslands, the kinds of lives that were supported out there were very rich and varied and don't really quite fit the categorization of a desert. That said, if you ran out of water out there, people would be facing a really difficult set of choices in the near term. And I think that what we need to do is really start to imagine what that transition could look like now and give people the support in our rural communities, the support that they need to transition to more sustainable relationships with the aquifer, with the land, and with the future.
You know, you have a very close personal tie to all of this and this issue based on your own family's history farming out there. When you visited your father for this book, you talked about the Case engine waking you up in the morning as it pumped out like 1,400 gallons of fresh groundwater a minute. You remembered the sound of that engine when you were a little boy.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I grew up in Southwest Kansas, and five generations of my family are from out there. And when I was a kid, I spent my summers out on my dad's farm on the South Cimarron in Grant County. And you get used to the sounds of these big irrigation motors. It's kind of, along with the wind, it's the backdrop to a lot of life that happens. And I never thought about it, you know, and I never thought about writing about my family or Kansas or groundwater or any of these sorts of things until 2016, when I went back out there to reconnect with my dad. And, you know, he started talking about depletion and his concerns. And the more I learned, the more curious I became. It seemed like something that we could maybe share and hold in common. And then it turned out that there's this really remarkable set of stories that are going on out there. And, you know, depletion is a problem that implicates all of us in different ways.
How much has the water table dropped at your father's farm?
It's dropped more than 150 feet. And he's in an area where the groundwater declines are some of the highest in Southwest Kansas. And, you know, my great grandfather pioneered some of the early irrigation out there. And so the story of that dropping groundwater is really tied up with a lot of emotional things, a lot of things in my family that, you know, are often not talked about when we talk about groundwater. And I think that that's one of the keys to understanding what's happening, is that these are issues that go way beyond economics. They're issues that go way beyond politics, mm-hmm, or partisan slogans or divides. These are really about the fabrics of our families and our relationships to each other. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of hope in that. And there's also pretty high stakes for finding a better way.
Well, what does this mean for your family farm with the water table declining in the way that it has?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people around my dad's place can't keep going. Irrigation, which already, you know, growing irrigated corn in Western Kansas is often a losing proposition for many people, or people break even, or people have to overpump in order to meet the bottom line. So it was already a tricky proposition. But for a lot of people around my dad's place, you know, they can't pump. They can't pump the same, or their wells are down to a really small level, and they have to combine different wells into the same pivot, et cetera. And so people have to find another way forward. Some guys are switching to dry land. Some people are selling out. And that's what's happening all over Western Kansas.
You know, in the course of researching this book, you learned that your great-grandfather, R.W., he was responsible for draining a lot of the river near where your father's house is today, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so there's a family culpability here that runs through the different generations.
Yeah, I mean, that's what really was striking to me about this story. You know, we live in a moment where it's pretty easy to blame other people for our problems. And it's less easy or less comfortable for us to step back and try to take responsibility and put ourselves within the terms of the crises or catastrophes or problems that we want to solve now. And in the case of groundwater depletion for me, there was no way for me to remove myself from that. And I think that it's one of the things that I try to do in the book, is trace how groundwater moves between the generations in my family, and connects me to my father, connects my father to his mother, connects his mother to her father, and so on. And again, what you see is an emotional register for environmental change.
Hmm. You know, I think a lot of people in this part of the state, in the cities, if you will, sort of think, hey, a week's worth of heavy rains will solve the issue, or maybe a season of heavier than usual rain, things will be right back to the way they used to be. And one of the big warnings of your book is that's not true at all, is it?
No. I mean, there's no other way to say that other than the general process of climate change often exceeds the smaller scales by which we interpret it. And, you know, Southwest Kansas is in the grips of a mega drought. That's one of the worst droughts in 1,000 years. And we need to get used to the fact that that's the new normal. Instability is the new normal. So there's going to be years where you have way more rainfall than expected. And then there's going to be long stretches where that doesn't make up for the difference. And in any case, you know, agriculture right now is not set up to deal with those kinds of fluctuations in the same way. And people use irrigation water to kind of balance out the fluctuations of the weather or the climate. And that is also unsustainable. So we need to find a way to go back to living with the land, living within the natural cycles that are given to us, and respecting that.
Again, my guest is Lucas Basir. His book, Running Out in Search of Water on the High Plains. I was really interested in the meetings that you and your father went to at the Southwest Ground Management District, which is ostensibly set up to regulate water use. What surprised you, what surprised me, was that most of the policies of the district encouraged water use, and that wasn't what you expected. You expected maybe just the opposite. How does the district encourage water use?
Yeah, so for listeners who aren't familiar with this, the state of Kansas established 5 groundwater management districts in the 70s in response to local communities who wanted to control their own water destinies. And in many cases, there are groundwater management districts that are doing a good job. And, you know, especially groundwater management district number 4 has established district-wide controls and limits and reductions. But that is in sharp contrast to the kind of groundwater management policy that's in effect in Southwest Kansas, where you have huge multi-billion dollar corporate agricultural interests who are influencing the board, who are preventing certain kinds of initiatives to limit use. And you can see that the core of that problem is an exclusionary structure built into the Groundwater Management District Act that prevents people from voting or participating in those policy decisions. So only people who own 40 acres of land or water rights to 1 acre foot per year can participate in the groundwater management districts, which means that we're talking about a situation in rural Kansas where the vast majority of residents and citizens have no say. They're excluded from the political processes that will determine the future of their own communities and families.
In fact, some of the board members of these water districts are huge water users, you found out. They have a big stake in continuing to pump the aquifer dry.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're some of the biggest water users in the state, and it's an irony that the people who benefit the most are the people who are making the decisions. And I think that we have to be honest about the importance of that situation in perpetuating the problem and preventing more democratic solutions.
Let's go to Mike from South Kansas City, who's been holding for a bit. Mike, thanks for hanging on.
Yes, I think my big indicator of the water crisis out there is, here's my question. What was the price of land 10 years ago? What is it today?
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't have those figures right here in front of me, but it's true that there is a huge implication for running out of groundwater in terms of the real estate values, the tax assessments, and the potential tax revenues for these rural communities when the water runs out. Now, some people will say that transitioning to dry land also will drop the value of your land, but we're looking at economic pain one way or another, and a little bit of short-term pain may help us prevent the longer-term, larger pain that's in store if we don't get this problem under control.
Help us city kids understand a term here, dry land farming. Lucas, what does that mean?
Yeah, so there's irrigated farming and dry land farming. And dry land farming just means that people farm without the benefit of additional water or, you know, added irrigation water. So that means that you grow different kinds of crops. It means that the prices are different. It also means your input and your costs for infrastructure are different. And it means a different kind of relationship to the weather.
You know, the district oversees water rights that farmers own. Help me understand how farmers own water rights.
Farmers don't own water rights. I mean, they're the rights, the ownership of the water is held by the state, and then it's licensed, in effect, to different farmers. And so you're granting state resources, the use of state resources, to individuals and to groups in order to benefit the wider public good. And I think that there's a lot of conversations to be had around what exactly constitutes the public good in a situation where we know that the groundwater that everything depends on is running out.
You also found that conserving water doesn't have to be that difficult. In fact, a lot of farmers are overwatering their crops. How can that be?
Yeah, it was one of the most surprising things to me. And farmers themselves told me about this. This is not like, you know, some kind of expert insight that only I have. Everybody kind of knows. And people tended to overwater just to be safe or to be sure. And that's a long-standing habit that has come into place after the Dust Bowl when people started thinking about the aquifer as a kind of insurance to prevent, you know, backstop to prevent losses. But it turns out that in many cases, and part of that is due to more efficient technology, different seed varieties, et cetera, people are putting too much water on their crops. And if you reduce the amount of water you pump, you save money. You actually make more money pumping less water. And that's without touching the infrastructure or the logics or the system that's in place. And that's one of the most amazing insights about the work that was done in GMD4 up in Northwest Kansas, where farmers got together, decided to lower the amounts that they were using, and actually made more money doing so.
You know, another idea that's been around for decades are these, you know, you hear talk out there about these giant aqueducts that could funnel water from hundreds of miles away and bring it to Southwest Kansas or Western Kansas. This would obviously cost, you know, tens of millions of dollars. What are some of the ideas that have popped up over the years?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is something that comes up over and over and over again. And it's in the air right now. There's some lobbying going on, especially on behalf of big corporate agribusiness, because it's kind of a have your cake and eat it sort of a solution where you can, you know, justify eradicating a very complicated earth system that a lot of different people can benefit from by saying that you're just going to replace it with a different source of water, without addressing the questions of who controls that water, how are you going to distribute it, where does it go, how are you going to pay to pump it all the way back there, who's going to foot the bill, and how are you going to actually like address all of the complicated social and political and ethical issues involved in taking that amount of water from somewhere else and moving it out to Western Kansas. So the thing to know is that you may hear about the aqueduct. That's a long-standing myth on the plains. A lot of people have appealed to that idea. None of those examples have ever worked, and this present example isn't going to work either.
So where do you think we're going here then, Lucas? What's your prediction for the path ahead?
Well, I think we're at a crossroads, and I think that on one hand, we know the worst-case scenario, which is we give in to corporate power. We let a lot of lobbyists convince us that we have to delay. We don't come together. We continue to have meetings that don't get anything done. We don't hold our elected leaders accountable. And then a lot of rural people are going to suffer. And the people that are going to suffer the most are not the people who are profiting from this. They're the people who are already going through tougher times. And on the other side of that equation is we have wonderful people in the state of Kansas. There's a lot of expertise out there. There's a lot of great people who are committed to finding a better way. And we have to come together and build an alliance focused on turning those solutions and those ideas into actual remedies that are fair and transparent and benefit everybody.
And Lucas, just quickly, Eastern Kansas has a big stake here. If this farming economy goes south on us, it's going to mean trouble for a lot of us in Eastern Kansas, too, just quickly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This isn't just a local problem. This is a state problem. It's a national problem. We're all implicated in it, and we all have something to say about it. So I just hope that you get involved and contact your local leadership and learn more about the issue. Thank you so much.
That's Lucas Basir. His book is Running Out in Search of Water on the High Plains. Lucas, sure enjoyed having you. Thanks so much for the update.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
You bet. Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.